This is Audible.
Tansor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents It Won't Be Easy, an exceedingly honest and slightly unprofessional love letter to teaching. By Tom Rademacher. Narrated by Roger Wayne. Foreword. Dave Eggers. He is 14 years old. He is covered in zits. There are zits so big on his face that they obscure his vision. This can happen. There can be a growth on a young man's nose that actually impedes his vision, like a thumb blocking a camera lens. This young man with the vision-obscuring zits is somehow not so popular with the young women in his school. He is not happy about this, and he is not happy about being hopelessly late to puberty, and not happy about being cut from the tennis team, and that his home is loud, and his parents fight, and his dad drinks too much, and that the many times he's run away have gotten him nowhere. He is angry about all this, and he is angry about his foot odor. His foot odor is so bad that people know he is coming far before they see him. They actually smell him and his shoes coming. His mother insists he keep his shoes outside, in the garage, even during a Chicago winter, so when he puts them on, they are frozen but no less foul. His foot odor problem is so bad that one of his best friends at the time is another young man with terrible foot odor. They met in a locker room after gym class, because they were both trying to put foot odor powder in their shoes, and bonded over what worked and what didn't. This young man is angry, confused, and spends far too much time listening to Morrissey and riding his bike late at night. He hangs out with other rebellious young men, and together they commit uncountable acts of petty vandalism. They don't do terrible things, but they do stupid things that could, in a few years, become dangerous acts. He is a sophomore in high school, and in the fall he has to take a year-long English class. The second semester of the class involves studying the contemporary novel, but the first semester is called public speaking. It's the sophomore English requirement, and this young man has no interest at all in this class, which will require him to stand before his peers, with his enormous zits, to stand up and be looked at, when he wants only to be away, to be invisible. But the teacher is funny. The teenager is a fan of Monty Python, and this teacher, with his dry wit, seems like he would like Python too. On the first day of class, there is another young student, a red-haired young man named Hank, who announces to the teacher that from now on he'd like to be called Hans. The teacher accepts this readily. "You're going old world on us, huh?" the teacher says, and after that calls Hank Hans. This small allowance registers with the zit-covered young man. Interesting, he thinks. The first assignment in the class is to write a persuasive speech. The students in the class are asked to come up with a proposal for their persuasive speech and present it to the teacher, who will make sure it's worthy of pursuing. Other students propose speeches about standard persuasive things, like legalizing marijuana or a law forbidding the burning of the American flag. The teenage boy, though, feeling rebellious, decides he will challenge the teacher. So, for his persuasive speech, he proposes that he will try to convince the class that they should take a bicycle trip to the inner mantle of the Earth. The teenager has thought of only one real reason that taking a bicycle trip to the inner mantle of the Earth would be a good idea, and that reason is that a trip like that would be downhill, all the way. So the teenager thinks he's pretty clever, and he expects the teacher to fight him on this. After all, the teenager is used to fighting at home. He fights every day with his father, so why shouldn't he fight with his teacher? The teenager challenges the teacher with his ludicrous proposal, and instead of resistance, the teacher, in his dry-witted way, nods and says, "Well, that makes a certain sense. You've convinced me already." And he allows the teenager to write his persuasive speech about the appeal of biking to the inner mantle of the Earth. Now, I want to stop here and explain what just happened. What just happened was that a rebellious and angry teenager, who could very well have become an ever more angry teenager capable of real harm, has had his rebellion embraced and redirected into something like art. If the teacher had fought him on this, the teenager would have fought harder, and would have seen this slight as yet another reason the world was an unforgiving and unlistening place. the anger of any teenage boy multiplies quickly and can exact a terrible price. Instead, the teacher, being a man of great tolerance with a writer's heart and with a sense of humor, with acceptance instead of resistance, validated the young man's strangest notions, and the young man wrote the hell out of that bike trip speech and got an A-. He was heard. He was validated. Okay. The teenager's next speech is about how humanity needs to beware of the coming sheep apocalypse, that is, a situation whereby sheep, which have been lulling us into a false sense of complacency, take over the world. This is true. This is a true story. Again, the teacher accepts this proposal as an appropriate enough interpretation of the assignment and use of the English language, loudly implying that the interests of his students, no matter how bizarre, have to be accepted, that ideas are anarchic things, and that though the ideas can be anarchic, the form can be tamed, that even if the speech is about world-conquering sheep, if it's done well, it's valid and deserving of attention and dignity. The teenager delivers his sheep speech, laughs through half of it, but still gets an A-. The last speech the teenager makes that semester is not a goofy one. It is about how we need to focus on the positive, that sometimes some dark obstacle, it could be a giant spherical zit on one's nose, it could be domestic strife, it could be anything, can obscure all the good in the world, that we need to look around and look past these obstacles and seek out beauty, seek out grace. It is a corny speech. It has no edge. But somehow in the course of the semester, the young man has lost that edge, or has found a way to direct it. And because his writing has been validated by his teacher, he and a friend who also loves Monty Python, so much that this friend has adopted a British accent while living in suburban Chicago, together begin writing a column in the school newspaper called, "And Now for a Bit of Fun." It is absurdist and nonsensical, but they labor over every word. 10 drafts, 15 drafts, hoping that the speech teacher will like it. This newspaper column leads to the teenager's being asked to write for the school yearbook, which he does. And working on the yearbook leads to his joining the literary magazine, which has exactly 4 members, who all soon graduate and cede the magazine to him and another friend, the other foot odor friend. Together, the 2 young men with the school's worst foot odor problem take over the literary magazine. Is this justice? Sign of the apocalypse? Not the sheep one, but some other more frightening version? In any case, between all these projects, the teenager suddenly has a home. He has a tribe, and the tribe has elders. These elders are the school's English faculty, and they are held in a certain awe, because they know everything the tribe wants to know. They are a mysterious and holy sect, now seen by the teenager and his literary magazine friends as their clerics and guides. There is the literary magazine teacher advisor, Mrs. Lowy, who is getting on in years and has trouble with stairs, but who nonetheless insists on keeping her third-floor classroom because it's full of light and her paintings. She teaches the teenager everything about writing and editing fiction and poetry, and introduces him to the unparalleled joy in publishing. Every day she climbs the stairs, slowly, so slowly, going higher, toward the light, and the tribe follows. And in that third-floor atelier, they edit, and write, and assemble, and laugh, and feel like their tiny literary magazine is very much the center of the world, and has the power to change it. There is Mr. Benton, who has just bought and mastered the first Apple computer and laser printer, and who helps the foot odor boys make the magazine something clean and professional, shockingly professional, and who is an opera singer on the side, and who approaches the day, every day, with the inspired glee of a true believer. There is Mr. Hawkins, who teaches AP English, who introduces the teenager to Dostoevsky and Joseph Heller, and who is a singer-songwriter who brings down the house at every talent show. There is Mr. Creech, the head of the English department, whom the teenager wants so badly to please that he brings a copy of As I Lay Dying to class every day, even though it's not required reading, hoping to impress him. Mr. Creech is not impressed by the teenager carrying around unassigned Faulkner, but he likes a paper the teenager writes about Macbeth, so much that he writes at the top of it, "Sure hope you become a writer." Just those 6 words. This all happens just a year after the teenager has met this first teacher, Mr. Peter Ferry, and in that year just about everything changed in his life. He found his people. He found a voice. He found validation. He found purpose. That teacher and I still show each other our work. He's usually my first reader, after my wife. And now he has published 2 books, too. 2 fantastic novels I was proud to be able to read in manuscript form. So if you younger teachers out there think it ends when your students graduate, no such luck. They follow you around the rest of your lives, like it or not. I thank you, teachers, for what you do, and I warn you about the awesome, the original meaning of the word, which conveys a biblical power, the kind of awesome power you have. I salute you and urge you on. Originally given as a keynote speech to the National Council of Teachers of English National Convention in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on November 21, 2015. Introduction. The rules. My God, you should see the look of complete disappointment, of utter boredom, when I tell my friends I'm writing a book about teaching. Who wants to read a book about teaching? Not even teachers. Some friends, in a heroic attempt at supportiveness, suggest ways I could try to get the book I'm writing on lists at college teacher programs. They're being sweet. It's a fine thing when your best-case scenario is that some people may read your book. Maybe. So long as it's a requirement to do so. I'm not writing a book to sell books, though. I'm writing a book about teaching because I have some things to say about teaching. I don't know yet, but I think this book would make a great book club book for teachers looking for yet another excuse to drink. I'm writing this book because I often feel like I'm on an island as a teacher. I often feel like I sit through training after unhelpful training from PhDs and various people who have given up on or never attempted actually teaching to get to tell people how to do it right, and I feel like those people are generally missing the point. Usually the icebreaker is the best part, and I genuinely, deeply hate icebreakers. I wrote the book I wish I had when I was starting out, the book I would like to read in the times when I feel like I'm losing my way. I've been teaching a whole lot of years and have never read a whole book about teaching from cover to cover during the school year, so this book isn't designed to be experienced like that. I'd listen to this book alone, but I don't really like people that much. I did not write it alone. I wrote it with the strength and intelligence of colleagues and friends. It grew stronger with specific input by Sarah and Jade and Brandon and Alana. I leaned heavily on Mitra and made Peter promise to finish it if I died in a plane crash. Also, there's this insane family of people who have won their state's Teacher of the Year award who have adopted me as somehow worthy, and I shudder to think where I'd be as a writer, teacher, or advocate without them. I wrote most of this book in my head to myself 10 years ago. I wrote the rest of it in early mornings at my desk, during school breaks as I could, more than 3 weeks removed from school, and I always totally forgot what teaching is like, and after my daughter went to bed. I decided I would write a book while I was driving to Wisconsin for Christmas, and with a sleeping wife and sleeping child my only company, let my mind wander. In 10 years of teaching, I've mentored many students and new teachers, and found myself asking many of the same questions and telling many of the same stories. Not just about teaching, but what it means to be a teacher. I thought of all those stories, observations, and questions, everything I've learned in a decade of teaching, everything I wish someone had told me 10 years ago. As we drove, I would write in my head and scribble down thoughts and lists and a table of contents at every bathroom and meal stop on the way. The most enduring part of those first lists is what follows. My rules for teaching, and my rules for writing about teaching. They are as good an introduction as I can imagine for everything else you're about to hear. Or if this book has somehow made it to your book club, it will serve as enough reading to passably pretend you read everything else and try to impress your work crush. My rules of writing. Race is on the table. You can't be a teacher and not think about race. I don't care what your class looks like or what you look like. If you're talking about education and you're not talking about race, then you're not really talking about education. This book is written in the way that many teachers talk, with issues of race, gender, and sexuality infused into and informing the discussions about everything else. In a job full of humans, human issues are always a priority. No sugarcoating. I will show you my bad days as often as my good days. I will discuss the best and worst projects, attitudes, and reactions I've gotten from students. I am, on many days, prouder of the best of my worsts than the best of my bests. No research. For my book on teaching will not be or read like a PhD thesis with a cover and quirky name slapped on the front. The loudest voices in the education of youth have white hair, PhDs, and thousands of hours of more research than I am willing to do. But none of them speaks to me. Also, sometimes I feel like data are for people who don't understand people. I must be teaching to write about teaching. Because I hate every staff development training that starts out, "I used to be a teacher too, but 5 years ago," because it always sounds to me like the speaker couldn't hack it. Every right answer that I think I have about teaching and that I write all confident about will be subject to complete failure the next day in class, and will not benefit from the comfort of selective memory or a buffer of time. The best inventions from the best systems of pedagogy, debated and constructed by the best educational brains in the country, can be thoroughly, embarrassingly, and hilariously dismantled in 10 seconds by a 15-year-old who was just dumped by his girlfriend. If you pay attention, though, that kid is going to show you the little pieces that may be wrong in a big, good idea, or may show you that some big ideas sound wonderful away from real classrooms, but really have no business being there. This is not a teaching manual, except when it is. I'm not sure if it's possible to read something that will make you a better teacher. I think I figured some pretty big things out, so I'm going to say some things that may help out. They will be mostly big questions to sit and think about. There won't be any activities in here that you can use for 40 minutes in class, 15 minutes after you hear it. My rules of teaching. School is unfair. Let's imagine two students here. Both have been assigned a substantial project that requires work from home. Student one goes home to an afternoon snack and is directed by their parents to their study space, a desk and lamp set aside just for them and their full-time job of school. The student is redirected when they lose focus and praised when they've done well. They are called to dinner, which has been made for them, and their progress is checked before free time is given, time in which they are allowed to relax, enjoy their hobbies or friends, get themselves ready for the next day. Student two is many different students. They have parents who work or parents who party. They have siblings to take care of, or meals to make, or meals that will be missed. They smoke weed for all the reasons kids do, or they date, or they work. Or home is too loud, or home is unsafe, or home doesn't exist. Or they get sick when they look in the mirror, or get angry for almost no reason. Or they can't sit still or stay focused no matter the consequences. Maybe someone is sick, or they are. Or someone every day says things to them that make school and everything related feel awful. Or for any of the whatever reasons, they aren't getting their work done tonight. When they are called out for not having their work done tomorrow, they almost surely won't say why. When they are called on it again, and again, and told again and again they need to show more effort, they will feel like they are already doing impossibly too much. Also, school may be the only place where it is safe enough to laugh or quiet enough to sleep. Also, small reprimands or discouragements, small cuts at school can open deeper and older wounds. School says that student one is a good student, and that student two is a bad student. That may be true, if student means the ability to navigate school. Is student one smarter, more creative, more insightful than student two? On a lot of days, it's really, really hard to tell. Their grades would say so. That's something that's wrong with school, not something wrong with either student. School is unimportant. This is something I knew well when I was in school, and had been slowly trained to forget during teacher education and staff meetings about chewing gum, hats, and tardies. Education is important. The ability to think in complex ways, to understand the people and the world around you, the ability to find, filter, and synthesize information is important. School is not. Tests are unimportant. Binders and lockers, seating charts, due dates, points. Oh, all the talk about points. All the trappings, all the stuff of school is deeply unimportant and yet begs constant attention and energy from teachers, and often many hours of work from students. Teachers can spend incalculable amounts of time and energy on school goals that make no sense. We imagine that our importance lies in our authority, that as gatekeepers to the pieces of paper needed to get to the next step, we have some responsibility to be harsh, punitive, or realistic. We are preparing students for some real world we imagine will be best served by people who learned an important lesson by getting a D in health, and now care genuinely for people and are culturally competent critical thinkers. We worry constantly that we are not preparing our students for what they'll see in college, while we push for a system that excludes many from the opportunity to try. In 3 years, my students will remember very little of what I've attempted to teach them. If I'm lucky, skills will continue to transfer and build from year to year. Maybe the very core of what I'm teaching will transfer and stay with them in some way. If I'm unlucky, or there is a bee in the room on the wrong day, students will forget most of what I teach them. They will forget entire novels we will spend months reading only weeks after we finish reading them. They will not remember what a gerund is. They will, God forbid, forget which there/there/there is the right one to use to show possession. I have a year, sometimes less, to give them something useful to understand and remember. Why should we ask school to focus on anything that isn't going to be important to them? Compassion before all else. In my third year of teaching, just before the students came back from lunch, my whole teaching team was called to the office. Our principal delivered the news that one of our students, an eighth grade girl of profound talent and empathy, was about to be told that her mother just committed suicide. The girl's father was on the way, but we were to act as if everything was normal until he got there. The girl was in my next class, and that hour was without a doubt the hardest I have ever had as a teacher. All these years later, I can picture where the girl was sitting, the spot behind the lab table I stood in for most of the hour. I have this weird thing where I don't connect colors to emotion, so I never remember them. I can't tell you the color of any house I've lived in, including the one I'm currently sitting in. I can't tell you the color of my classroom or of any classroom I've ever taught in, or the color of the dress I put my daughter in this morning, or the color of a single flower, food item, or decoration at my wedding. But I remember vividly that the student was in yellow for the last hour of her life, before she found out her mom was dead. During the hour, I tried not to look at her too much, tried to act as normal as I could, tried not to break down, to run to her, to hug her and tell her 1,000 times, I'm sorry. I felt awful for knowing that I had no right to know and felt guilty for being able to teach, to joke with students, with that student in particular, knowing what I knew. As the hour ended, she was called to the office. After 20 minutes, her 3 closest friends were called up as well. News spread over the next few days, and the community rallied and supported her in ways impressive and beautiful. The girl's teachers became among the most important people in her life, but not as teachers. We were people, humans, who cared for her as a person. What she needed, the only thing she needed, for the last few months of school, was as much humanity and care and support as we could give her, and so we did, because more than teacher and students, she was a human. And we were all humans. Teaching is completely full of humans. Really, full of them. Real humans. Oh, and how often we forget. Oh, and how much did any training, education, staff development, or research about teaching get me ready for my most trying moments? For that or any other of the many times I've felt the most effective and important and influential at my job? Not at all. Because teaching is only sometimes about teaching. Teachers are far too often complaining about not getting to do their jobs because they don't get enough time just saying things for kids to write down. Teaching is so rarely that, is more often about doing all the work to get a student to that moment, is more often supporting a kid who is far away from being taught that day. I am not an expert teacher. My 10 full years feel plenty long to me, but are eclipsed by triple by at least a few people in my building. They are experts. I have a master's degree in English education, but if I'm honest, I didn't really work all that hard at it. So, I promise no answers. In the short time I've been doing this, I have learned that anyone promising answers to teaching is almost surely full of shit. I have my answers, and I'm sure I'll end up sharing everything I think I've learned, but my answers work for me in the building I work, and with the students I have. If there were one method of instruction, assessment, or classroom management that worked well for everyone, then teaching would be ridiculously easy, and we'd all be a lot better at it. Anyone who's done it for longer than a day knows that teaching is a messy business. Each school is different, and each classroom for that matter, and each group of students and each kid is different, and every kid is different on different days, or by different friends, or doing different sorts of things. Messy, messy, messy. I found that applying a system broadly, any system, no matter how well engineered or well intentioned or well researched, means you miss kids. And means kids miss opportunities. This is the problem with most books, manuals, and teacher education classes. They skip to the final step and don't spend nearly long enough on the core reasons why we do what we do. So often while I got my license, I heard professors say, "We're all here for the right reasons." So often in staff meetings now I hear, "We all want the same thing for students." And then we jump to how we get to that thing. We don't talk about the reasons. We don't spend time on the questions that created the answers in the first place. We really like to talk about strategies. In interviews, we love teachers with great answers about classroom management strategies. We love to talk about grading strategies, how to put desks where, how to stand or sit when talking to students in which situations. When we're done with strategies, we talk about policies. I hereby suggest that all strategies are either equally bullshit or equally valuable. What we do is far less important than why we do it. All the carefully implemented management strategies won't matter for shit if you don't know your kids and they don't know you care about them. Answers don't make good teachers. Questions do. This simple statement took me every moment of the first 6.5 years of my teaching to really understand. I read a lot about teaching when I was in school to be a teacher. We talked all the time about all the different things we would need. We talked so often about strategies. Strategies were named, then acronymed, taken as notes, discussed as theoreticals. Never once was there a strategy introduced for what to do when a student finds out in the middle of your class that their mother has died tragically. Any strategy presented anywhere would be wrong anyway. Besides, it was an intense day. The hardest day I've ever had as a teacher, but is one of only about 100 different times I've had a student in crisis in front of me. Sometimes they wear those crises like fire. They scream and they spread and they destroy. Sometimes they wear those crises like Frodo wore the ring, secretly around their necks, weighing them down. Is it inappropriate to make a Lord of the Rings reference regarding students in crisis? It is. There is no right way to treat those kids. No strategy that makes their parents' death not hurt, that makes their home suddenly safe, that makes their addiction disappear. We can be kind. We can care. That student, those students, is the reason this book is full of questions. You may have one group figured out in May, but you'll get a new group in September, and you'll learn, because we all learn, that what worked last year won't work this year. Each year's class is a whole new group of humans complete with all the mess of humans. Their lives are not static. So we can't be static. We can ask the same questions every year, the questions that have given us success, the questions that have helped us help kids. But we can't expect the same answers. Can't assume the answers will be the same without asking. Teaching is hard. And one of the hardest things about it is that it never gets easy. Welcome to the Shit Show. Part 1. Summer. In summer, we reflect on the year we had, and have weird worry dreams about the year on the way. We find jobs and prepare, mentally and physically. Also, We sometimes drink at noon outside on a beautiful day when all our sucker friends are working in offices. Welcome to the Shit Show. All of the soon-to-be-questioned choices in your life have led to this moment. You are standing in front of a group of students you are supposed to teach. Okay? Now what? You want to know what's going to happen? Total ridiculousness. All the time. If you don't have teacher friends, get teacher friends. Because no one else will understand or believe the stories that you will bring home. There will be a point when your days will contain a handful of crying kids, a few legitimate crises, a level of infighting and pettiness among staff members that would make middle school mean girls blush, and at least one moment where you are working with a student, your head in your hands, pleading desperately for them to either just put their name on a thing that will keep them from failing, or to stop, pretty please stop, putting that thing inside their ear. It will get stuck there, and only an ER visit will remedy the situation. When someone asks you what happened at that workday, you will respond, "Nothing, really." Because that will be a pretty normal and unremarkable day. Welcome to the Shit Show. I mean it, really. Welcome. We're glad to have you and, in fact, really need you. I also mean it, really mean it, that schools are a shit show. Every one of them, nearly all the time, for a million different reasons. Very early in my first year, really like 2 weeks in at most, I was out in the hallway, checking on a group. We were doing Romeo and Juliet, and the kids were all doing 2-minute movies of each act so we could compile a 10-minute version of the play and get all that plot garbage out of the way. Because if you're teaching Shakespeare to study his broke-ass, stolen plots and not the language, well then, you, sir, are no friend of mine. But, yeah. I was out talking to the group doing the third act, which includes all sorts of great Mercutio stuff, including his death, which is that huge moment where the play flips from a comedy to a tragedy, but in this case meant a lot of kids with Nerf swords banging the hell out of each other in a conference room and needing at least a little supervision. I was out of my room for maybe 2 minutes, and when I came back in, there was a large table flipped over and a silence that could only have meant that I missed something big. At first, the students in the class were holding steady to the story that no one flipped the table. Me. Was it flipped before? Students. No. Me. Is it flipped now? Students. Yes. Me. So what happened? Students. Nothing. Me. Get back to work. 10 minutes later, after asking questions of the scared kids who I knew would tell me everything, and did, it turned out that two students who are always bickering started straight up fighting. Ben, who hates Victoria and loves her, was being ruthless to Victoria. Victoria, who hates Ben and loves him, had had too much and launched at Ben, wrapping her hands around his throat and sending them both over a table. So that was the thing that happened that day. I brought Ben and Victoria together into the hallway. Me. What happened? Them. Nothing. Me. Nothing. Did someone get choked? Them. Yes. Me. Did you both fly over a table and knock it over? Them. Yes. Me. So what happened? Them. Nothing. Just two kids, you know, doing what kids do, you know. Just a little choking and some tackling, but pretty much nothing. They really weren't trying to get out of trouble. They were actually pretty surprised that it was something they could get in trouble for. Through all my work, through an arduous and unseemly process of licensure and untold hours writing essays about research I didn't really read, I had asked to be there in that moment. And on that same day, on that same goddamn day, in the middle of another class, a girl reached straight down the front of her shirt and pulled a penny from her bra. Another student sitting close by saw the whole thing happen and went, "Ew!" in the way that middle school kids do when confronted with things that are different than things that involve bras. The girl turned to the boy and, exercising really her only option at that point, threw the penny at the boy and hit him in the leg. I have no idea what she had that penny for, or why it was in her bra, or why that moment was the moment that she just had to have it out of her bra, but okay. The bra penny had been cast and hit the kid with really no force at all, except the cosmic weight of a penny that had just been removed from someone's shirt. So the boy, this kid, did what he felt was the only proper response. He screamed, he wailed, he professed again and again that his leg had been killed. When he walked, he did so dragging his leg behind him, lifeless. He did this through the rest of the class. And then on the way to lunch, during recess, and yes, all through games of volleyball at gym. I talked to him about it. Every adult all day talked to him about it, first pleading and then demanding that he stop pretending his leg was dead. I distinctly remember, and this was a moment I had worked my ass off for years to be in, work that I had gone into deep debt to get the chance to do, a job that I had literally, actually assassinated three competitors to have, and I remember sitting with this kid after a few hours of his dragging around his leg behind him in the hallway and telling him, "I understand you didn't want a bra penny thrown at you, but acting like that penny killed your leg is really pretty offensive." "I'm not acting," he replied. "It's really dead. The penny killed it." This is not the weirdest conversation I've had with a student, and he dragged his leg off to math. A not small part of me was impressed with his commitment to the bit. One more from my first year. There was this kid, Ian, with long straight hair he was constantly flipping out of his eyes, jeans that cost more than my car, and the sort of pudgy confidence that comes with being from an especially wealthy family. "I don't have to work in school," he once told me, "because I'm already smarter than most people. And I'm just going to have a job at my dad's company anyway." Okay. The thing about Ian is that, all that aside, he was generally an okay kid, so long as no one was suggesting that it wasn't okay for him to be the center of the world at all times. For example, he excelled at giving presentations, but was absolutely god-awful when it was time for someone else to speak. Just before winter break, we were doing just such a thing, each student presenting to the class on three different dialects used in their lives. Ian sat near the back, and I sat near Ian, hoping my proximity would keep him from bothering each and every presenter. He did, for the most part, leave them alone, but only because he spent the entire hour turned sideways in his chair, looking right at me, trying to have a conversation with me while I tried to focus on the front of the room.
"Have you ever been a vegetarian? What do you think shark tastes like? How many people do you think it would take to lift a car off the ground? What's your favorite country?"
Question after inane question went unanswered. I thought, I hoped, that ignoring him would possibly make him give up. Actually, I didn't really think it would help, but I was curious what would happen if I gave him absolutely zero of the attention he was asking for.
"Hey, guess what?"
"Nothing."
"Guess what I can do?"
Staring forward.
"I can fit my hand in my mouth."
Nope, not responding, just grading presentations. And then he was screaming. Well, he was screaming as well as he could with his hand in his mouth. Yep, it had gotten stuck there. His entire fucking hand, stuck in his mouth. Teaching is a shit show. And that shit show really hits you during the beginning of your career, during the beginning of every year, the end of every year, when you started a new school, and for any chunk of days before or after a break or a long weekend. Yes, that leaves, like, 3 days of the year that are pretty chill. Teachers say, "This is a hard part of the year," about every part of the year but summer. Believe me, I know. Because though all these stories so far have been from my first year of teaching, I'm now in my 10th, and though I really kind of feel like I know what I'm doing, I'm trying to do those things in a new building, and I'm getting my ass handed to me. I am now that teacher who will ask a student to get to class, please and please again and again, and be ignored when I'm lucky and not told off for getting all in someone's business, until another teacher walks by and says, "Class," and off the student will go. I was that teacher last year, the teacher who could move the unmovable child, who could pipe in obnoxiously in meetings for a student removing bricks of the school one at a time, about how well that student was doing in my class, and, "Hey, here's an example of a cool project they did for me. Oh, they glued all your desks to the wall while you turned around for 3 seconds? Weird. That hasn't happened in my room." I was that teacher last year. And this year I'm spending as much time scrubbing bitch or D's nuts, somehow again a thing, off a wall as I am doing my actual real job. A lot of the time, it just takes a lot of time. A lot of the time, it takes standing in front of a student and taking their worst and coming back the next day, because they are trying to scare you away. The broken of my new school has very little in common with the broken I left, so I need to learn this new broken better. There are simple things you can do, and they mostly mean spending time now to make things easier later. Going to lunch or recess, or hanging with your kids in art, or talking to them like real-life people who are somehow, for the first time ever in humanity, struggling with adolescence. The most important thing to do is understand the insanity. Embrace the shit show, but don't let it become you. I've seen too many teachers act in school like they are back in school. They track student relationships and friendships. They spend hours navigating the interpersonal drama of students. Things that are very little of their business and ultimately are important for kids to figure out by themselves. Those teachers often spend an equal number of hours on the rumors and power struggles on staff, a game of who said what to whom that a good many of us were happy to leave behind in seventh grade. When you're surrounded by drama and downright ridiculousness, it's hard not to see those things as a legitimate way to work, but they are not. Your job as a grown-ass person in a school building is to act like one. Ride the insanity as often as you can. Ignore it when you can't. And drink at night when neither of those things works. The other day, I was helping out with recess, trying to wrangle kids who would rather not be wrangled just before a long weekend. It was time for the middle school to be out there, so I was surprised to see a rather large group of elementary students run from the small wooded area a little more than 10 minutes after their recess was supposed to be over. I barked at them and pointed, not generally that interested in getting too close to kids that small, but they beelined for me anyway.
"There's a body back there!
Go to... wait, a fuck what now? A what?
There's a body! Tyler said he saw a body and we went and looked."
Deep breath.
"And I saw its face and Angel saw its fingers."
Deep breath.
"So it's a body and it's back in the woods and we had to go see it."
Yeah, okay. So I got them to head back toward the building and started walking, I guess, to go and find the body. That's what I was doing with my day at that point. Lesson plan, sure. Do attendance, grade some papers, all that makes sense for a teacher to do. Go and find a body in the woods. Yeah, it's got to be in the job description somewhere. The little wooded area was creepy as hell, a truly random assortment of the kinds of things people throw into a wooded area that kind of doesn't belong to anyone. Under no circumstances, of course, were kids supposed to go back here during recess, which means they nearly always do. I spent about 10 minutes just looking around all the crap. I was being quiet, you know, so as not to warn the dead body I was coming in case it tried to get me. There was a giant broken flat-screen TV, 3 shopping carts belonging to stores that were all at least 5 miles away, and a crappy old sleeping bag that, when looked at just right, kind of, I guess, looked like it could be a body. It wasn't. I mean, I wasn't going to go nudge it with my foot or anything to make sure, but it wasn't. Nobody there. No body there. My principals were in a meeting that I had to pull them from, and I got to start a conversation with, "Okay, so just know that there isn't a body in the woods." It took about an hour of walking from room to room, and then the social worker going to check, and then the school cop guy going to check before just about all the students stopped spreading the rumor that there was a body in the woods. Turns out it was probably a ghost. And this all happened right around lunchtime, and by the time I got home and my wife asked me how my day was, I answered, "Pretty good, pretty normal." Only during the next day, when we were watching the news, did I remember, "Oh yeah, yesterday I was pretty sure I was about to find a dead person at work, but I didn't." How did you not lead with that when you walked in the door? Forgot. Hey, you know what? This will be your life. This and so many more things will be the constant experience of being you as long as you have this job. But here's the thing, and the thing that will maybe help you at some point. It's not just your kids. It's not just your school. Kids are weird. Teachers are weirder. And when you smash them all together for 100-whatever days a year, really weird things happen. Some of those weird things are brilliant. Some of them are downright terrible. But none of them will happen only at your school, only in your room, only because of you. You asked for this, but you're not alone. The interview. I student taught in a high school where students were patted down and walked through metal detectors every morning. I went to a high school in an affluent suburb in Wisconsin. My school is one of the top schools in the state in college acceptance and featured shockingly great facilities for theater, athletics, and certain kinds of music. In my high school, hats were banned for fear they might be used as a way to signal gang affiliations. That term, gang affiliations, was said in whispers. The worry that a gang would somehow infiltrate a school that had snowmobile parking in the winter, that students would become spontaneously infected by ganginess, that the infection would spread through hat wearing, was a tangible fear our administration carried around in their front pockets. When I student taught, hats were still banned but almost constantly worn. No one worried much about the hats showing gang affiliation, because no one was trying very hard to hide their gang affiliations. Most actual gang activity happened just off school grounds, but occasionally friction from outside the building found its way in.
One time, a group of kids who were not students at the school kicked their way in through a side door to jump someone in the hallway. Another time, two groups fought in the hallway right in front of our classroom. My cooperating teacher, 7 months pregnant and 10 times the badass I will ever be, was running into the fray to pull out one student who would be in danger of expulsion if he was caught fighting again. I stopped her, and we made a quick decision that she would hold our kids in the room while I attempted to grab our student from the mob. Just as I reached the group, the police officer assigned to the building reached the top of the stairs and pepper-sprayed the whole group, me included. I had never found occasion to be pepper-sprayed before that moment, so it was a novel experience for me. Snot came out of my nose, mouth, and eyeballs. It wasn't pleasant. Although the event was among the more memorable experiences of my student teaching, it wasn't really indicative of the larger experience. I loved the school, the teachers in the school, and most especially the students there. I learned many, many things that kept me from completely bursting into flames in my first year, and many things that helped me in the interview that eventually got me the job I still hold. The day of my job interview started with fossils. I originally wasn't going to go on the field trip. I thought about taking the morning off to rest up and rehearse God knows what before heading into my first teaching interview. But then the day before the trip, there was a planning meeting, and the teaching team decided that though most students would be grouped into their first-hour classes, there was a group of 6 or 7 kids with particular problems in the area of self-control that could use a smaller group. The problem, of course, was finding a staff person who would be in charge of that group. I had a good relationship with many of the students, who were all in an afternoon class I taught called Literacy, which was meant for students more than 2 grade levels behind in reading who did not qualify for special ed. In other words, kids who had been screwed by more than a few parts of life, and who we couldn't seem to stop screwing. So I was volunteered. "It won't be a problem," my cooperating teacher told me, "because we'll be back at school an hour before your interview, which will be plenty of time." Of course. It rained all night and some of the morning, but why would that stop us? The buses were ordered. It stopped raining just by the time the buses got to the park where we would, if there was a god, find a fucking trilobite. I do not remember if we found one or not. I know at one point we saw a frog, and it scared the living shit out of one of the kids, the 17-year-old girl who had never seen a real frog before. I also know there was mud, and that under that mud there was more muddier mud. In some places, there was gravelly stuff that was unlikely to yield science-y finds but looked less muddy, and so was where we focused our efforts, though we quickly found that under the gravelly stuff was just gravelly, muddy mud. Mud, or poor planning, or both, meant that we did not finish up and get back on the bus until right about the time that we were supposed to be back at school. Drumming nervously on the green vinyl seat in front of me did not help our bus get us to the school any faster than 20 minutes before my interview. The second floor boys' bathroom of a high school isn't the best place to feel professional, but I did my best to wipe the mud from my face and neck down to my chest and from my hands up to my wrists. A suit was applied carefully over the mud covering the rest of my body, and I was off to try to convince a group of people to put me in charge of the future of our nation. On the way over, I promised myself I would not show anyone the mud. I tried many hand gestures and sitting postures to make sure the shirt would not slide up or down in a way that would show that most of my body remained completely covered. I got lost on the way to the school, and then couldn't find the door, and then got into the school and got lost in the school. A teacher found me standing in the hallway, turning in circles, looking for something. They asked if they could help, and I explained to them I was on a field trip all day and was now late to an interview in this building somewhere. Ah, and where was the office? By the front door. Where was the front door? By the front of the school. Of course. I totally could have thought of that myself, if not for the trilobites. I managed to be just barely on time, if not a bit frantic. I was led to a conference room with an already sitting interview committee. They looked a lot like a room full of people who had been interviewing dicks like me all day long. They did not light up upon seeing that I held many copies of my portfolio. They did appreciate the much shorter collection of best-ofs that could be flipped through in 5 minutes and that had little stickers on every page explaining what each was and why. That there was an actually helpful piece of advice for interviewing. Make one of those. No one wants to look at your whole damn portfolio. Everyone introduced themselves, and then we sat quiet. The silence seemed like a tricky interview trick. Am I supposed to start?
No, the principal isn't here yet. We just have to wait. It wasn't a tricky trick.
Oh, more quiet.
So my arms are totally full of mud right now.
I'm not good at shutting up.
Suddenly I was talking about trilobites and mud and buses and getting lost. I was also rolling up my shirt sleeves to show them just how filthy I was under my suit. My legs, I promised, were similarly muddy, but I did not, thank God, lift them above the table to prove my point. So I broke my rule about the mud pretty early on. Telling the story gave me a chance to humble brag about being chosen to be with a group of troublesome kids. Showing off my mud like a war wound won me some points with the science teacher. Eventually, the principal made it in after handling a bus issue, and the interview began. Each member of the interview committee, three teachers I would be working closely with, the principal, the director of HR, and her assistant, had a sheet in front of them of interview questions. The group went around the table, each reading a question in turn. I passed around my best-of sheet, and everyone flipped through it when it wasn't their turn to ask a question. My portfolio, probably 100 sheets of paper, lesson plans, and everything else I had worked the past year and a half to compile, sat unopened on the table. There were many questions, maybe 20, but I remember a few clearly now and remember my answers pretty well. So here's my interview, as best as I can remember, and removing what I'm sure were plenty of instances of, let me think. Oh, and I should point out that the principal came in, sat in the back corner, and looked almost immediately like he had fallen asleep. He did not read questions, so I was pretty sure from the outset that I was screwed and ended up answering honestly and emotionally, instead of trying to guess what they wanted to hear. Also, I'm going to throw in hints, like this, in case you're planning for your own interviews.
Glasses math teacher. What do you think your biggest strengths are as a teacher?
Me. My flexibility and my creativity. The other day, there was an all-school assembly that wasn't announced until the school day had already begun. It was supposed to last the entirety of my fifth hour, but it only lasted half the hour or so. I suddenly went from having an hour-long lesson plan to thinking I would do none, to suddenly having about a half hour with kids who were completely wound up from having their day interrupted. So I knew my other lesson wouldn't work, and I didn't want to give them free time or study hall or anything. So I quickly came up with a little creative writing thing we could all do together. It was high energy and social, and we had a really good time with it.
Note, tell stories when you can. Narratives about your teaching make you a person and give you a chance to explain who you really are as a teacher. Do that. Spiky-haired social studies teacher. What is something you would change about education if you could?
Me. I have a student right now, and from the first day I've met him, he said that he wants to be a rapper. Just about the only thing he cares about, just about the only thing he will work at, only he's scared of performing. I've noticed, and I don't mean to call other teachers out, but I've noticed that when a lot of teachers talk to this student, or about the student, they talk about all the things that are like rap that he could do. He could be a sound engineer, or a promoter, or could go into production of some sort. It's like they're applying this middle-class white lens about what success is to what the student is saying, instead of just listening to what the kid is saying. So I work with him on stage fright, talk about when I was nervous performing and what I would do. And I encourage his rapping. So that didn't totally answer the question, except for that kid, but the thing teachers are doing to that kid is happening all over schools. We are applying our own standards of success, or what sorts of jobs or lives are acceptable or desirable to the kids we have, instead of listening to what they really want.
Note. More stories.
Also, the principal looked like he woke up a little at this one, and then just looked sort of angry or maybe hungry, and then looked like he fell asleep again. He may also have just been staring at his phone. Also, most schools are looking for teachers who care enough about the profession to have ideas about the profession. Look for questions like this.
Actual glitter makeup on science teacher. Tell us about a time that you were challenged as a teacher, and what you did to meet that challenge.
Me. Well, okay. That just happened a few weeks ago now. There's a student I have now, and his name is Jordan. Jordan can be pretty hard to engage in school, but is generally pretty interested in talking. The other day he came in just completely shut down, obviously upset. I let him alone during class because honestly he just looked violently angry, and I was worried about pushing him at all. When class ended, he just sat there as the other kids emptied out, just sat there and stared down at his desk. It was my prep hour, so it was just the two of us, and I went and sat by him, just sat quiet for a few minutes, and then he just started letting everything out. The night before, his older brother had been shot and killed. Someone was mad at him and shot him in the chest with a shotgun, and he had died immediately. So I grew up in an all-white suburb in Wisconsin, and here's this kid just breaking down in front of me, and his brother has been shot. And, you know, they don't cover that stuff in education classes. So I just listened. I don't know why, but it seemed like more than anything it would be good to walk. But I didn't want to walk around the hallways where everyone would see him crying and want to ask him about stuff. So we walked outside. I also didn't want to leave school property, so we just walked the block of the school. We probably did the lap 10 times over the hour, and he just talked and I just listened. We went back inside before the next class started, and he gave a really quick, "Okay, thanks," and walked down the hall. I have no idea if I did the right thing or did anything, but it was the thing I did. Note, you don't need a huge tragedy to answer this question, but you do need honesty. Almost certainly, the people in the room of your interview will know what teaching is like, and an answer about how you just work too hard and teach too perfect won't fly. Every day is full of legitimate challenges, admit it. How you handle them is the important part. Math glasses teacher, whom I didn't know yet, but who would turn out to be the absolute best teacher I've ever worked with. Sorry, all those other teachers. Do you have any questions for us? Me. What is your school like for the kids who go here? Note. I pulled this question out of my ass, but was told later it was the moment that secured the job for me for the most of the room. Most people use this question to ask about benefits, salary, work hours, and a million other things about them. I used it to ask about the student experience, and I gave the people in the room a chance to talk about the things in their school they were the most proud of without asking them directly. They loved it. Steal this. The interview ended, and everyone stood up to shake my hand, except the principal, who appeared to now be checking his email, and gave me a little wave on my way out. I learned later that I was the last interview of the day, and when I left, everyone sat down to talk over the candidates. Before the conversation could begin, the principal stopped everyone and said, "It's obvious, right?" The next day, as I was walking out of school, I got a call. "Hello. This is HR person calling to let you know that we'd like to offer you the job you interviewed for yesterday."
"Really?"
"Yes. If you have some questions for me, I'd be glad to answer them. Otherwise, if you need some time, I can give you my number so you can call me back with your answer."
"Really?"
"Yes, Mr. Rademacher. You're the first choice and the first person we've called. The principal asked that we call your references today so we could offer you the job as soon as possible. I'm sure you have some questions about salary and benefits, and if you'd like to schedule a meeting with me before you make your decision, I'd be glad to make time for you in the next day or two."
"Really?"
"Really."
So I had my first teaching job, and it would be a decade before I applied for another. I credit getting and loving my job in the district with my honesty in the interview. When I look back on it, if I wasn't such a cocky ass or if I hadn't assumed it was a losing cause anyway, I wouldn't have called out schools on systemic racism. I wouldn't have admitted taking a student for a walk in the middle of the school day. And I certainly wouldn't have flaunted muddy arms to a table of strangers. Ultimately, though, I wouldn't have been happy at a school that wouldn't want me to do those things. Job hunting can feel desperate, and can legitimately be desperate. But an interview is a chance to get to know a school as much as it is a chance for the school to know you. Come with questions. Come with ideas of what you're looking for in a teaching environment. It may be that the perfect place isn't there for you right away, but that doesn't mean you should settle for a place you will hate. Getting along with grown-ups. It is June 28, which is almost July. Almost July, and I'm on vacation with my daughter. My mom owns a small condo on a large river, and because Grandma can't say no to grandchildren, I have slept an hour longer than my daughter. I cannot call it sleeping in when anyone without children is still asleep. My mom and daughter are outside by the river, tossing bread to squirrels, because this is apparently a thing people do here.
It should be noted that here, in this case, is Wisconsin. But maybe that's obvious, that with the whole bread-slash-squirrels thing. Birds are chirping sweetly. The sun